Centralizētais eksāmens angļu valodā – optimālais mācību satura apguves līmenis.
Hello, this is the listening part of your exam in English. It will consist of three tasks. You will hear the texts twice. Task 1, you have 45 seconds to read the task.
Speaker 1.
I was a legal secretary at a big corporation at the time in Walnut Creek, California, and I was bored out of my mind. I think I was watching a soap opera and just bored to death. And my sister handed me my first romance. And I'm telling you, it just took me to another place, another time. And it was so amazing, that escapism I experienced that day, that I started writing that day. I literally started writing that day.
Speaker 2.
About 10 years ago, a friend of mine went to New York City, and she talked to Todd Robinson at the time. Todd Robinson was publishing his own books, but he's also publishing a great quarterly magazine of hard-boiled crimes. She talked to him about my writing. I had actually written a fantasy novel at that time that wasn't really going anywhere. And so anyway, he suggested to her to suggest to me to write a crime story and send it in, because he was always looking for new writers. And I did that, and that's when things just clicked. And it was one of those things where I wasn't trying to be a crime writer at the time. I was trying to be a fantasy and horror writer, but something about crime writing just clicked with me.
Speaker 3.
Going all the way back, I started at the age of emails in the 1990s. I started finding that I couldn't stop writing when I was writing simple emails. And people, I would get positive feedback. And I just, this is amazing, because when I was growing up, I was literally told by English teachers that I should not try writing. I should just try to avoid it altogether. I was inarticulate and so forth. But I think I'm just naturally inclined to be a communicator. I really am not shy of speech. And I have a pretty, I think, natural flow of consciousness. And I think anybody that's an author, that's whether they're in success or not success, but enjoys authoring, will tell you that they're like that.
Speaker 4.
I've been writing sort of, you know, short stories or little novels, you know, for as long as I can remember. That's, you know, and reading a ton. And then basically taking as many writing classes as I possibly could, because that was the thing I always just loved to do, and writing short stories. And then I started turning one of these short stories into a novel.
Speaker 5.
So I always wanted to write. When I was 11, I wrote a full-length crime novel, actually. I always wanted to be a writer, but, you know, you never quite know how to do that, do you? And I suppose I did a lot of the right things in that I read English at university, and then I went to work in a library and eventually worked for a publishing company, and actually sort of worked my way up to become publishing director for children's fiction. But strangely, that sort of put me off writing myself. I'm not even sure why it was. So it wasn't until I was on maternity leave, I suddenly thought, oh, I'm going to try again. I'm going to try and write a book. And that book eventually became my first published book.
Speaker 6.
When I was a kid, I read science fiction, and I read a lot of nonfiction. So I was an English major at Michigan, and when I came back to New York, I wanted to keep reading, because I always, always, always want to read. But I didn't want to keep hurting my head by reading T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound. And so I was looking around. So I thought, I'll read some mysteries. And I picked up Hound of the Baskervilles. And it was late at night. I was reading in bed. But I remember this one scene in The Hound of the Baskervilles. Dr. Mortimer says, Holmes, they were the footprints of a gigantic hound. I got goosebumps. My hair on my arm stood up and everything. And I was hooked. And I read voraciously. And I was loving all of that. I loved solving the puzzles or trying to solve the puzzles. And I recognized, wait a minute, this is great fun to read, but it's also serious literature.
You have 30 seconds now to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
Speaker one.
I was a legal secretary at a big corporation at the time in Walnut Creek, California, and I was bored out of my mind. I think I was watching a soap opera and just bored to death. And my sister handed me my first romance. And I'm telling you, it just took me to another place, another time. And it was so amazing, that escapism I experienced that day, that I started writing that day. I literally started writing that day.
Speaker two.
About 10 years ago, a friend of mine went to New York City, and she talked to Todd Robinson at the time. Todd Robinson was publishing his own books, but he's also publishing a great quarterly magazine of hard-boiled crimes. She talked to him about my writing. I had actually written a fantasy novel at that time that wasn't really going anywhere. And so anyway, he suggested to her to suggest to me to write a crime story and send it in, because he was always looking for new writers. And I did that, and that's when things just clicked. And it was one of those things where I wasn't trying to be a crime writer at the time. I was trying to be a fantasy and horror writer, but something about crime writing just clicked with me.
Speaker three.
Going all the way back, I started at the age of emails in the 1990s. I started finding that I couldn't stop writing when I was writing simple emails. And people, I would get positive feedback. And I just, this is amazing, because when I was growing up, I was literally told by English teachers that I should not try writing. I should just try to avoid it altogether. I was inarticulate and so forth. But I think I'm just naturally inclined to be a communicator. I really am not shy of speech. And I have a pretty, I think, natural flow of consciousness. And I think anybody that's an author, that's whether they're in success or not success, but enjoys authoring, will tell you that they're like that.
Speaker four.
I've been writing sort of, you know, short stories or little novels, you know, for as long as I can remember. That's, you know, and reading a ton. And then basically taking as many writing classes as I possibly could, because that was the thing I always just loved to do, and writing short stories. And then I started turning one of these short stories into a novel.
Speaker five.
So I always wanted to write. When I was 11, I wrote a full-length crime novel, actually. I always wanted to be a writer, but, you know, you never quite know how to do that, do you? And I suppose I did a lot of the right things in that I read English at university, and then I went to work in a library and eventually worked for a publishing company, and actually sort of worked my way up to become publishing director for children's fiction. But strangely, that sort of put me off writing myself. I'm not even sure why it was. So it wasn't until I was on maternity leave, I suddenly thought, oh, I'm going to try again. I'm going to try and write a book. And that book eventually became my first published book.
Speaker six.
When I was a kid, I read science fiction and I read a lot of nonfiction. So I was an English major at Michigan. And when I came back to New York, I wanted to keep reading because I always, always, always want to read. But I didn't want to keep hurting my head by reading T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound. And so I was looking around. So I thought, I'll read some mysteries. And I picked up Hound of the Baskervilles. And it was late at night. I was reading in bed, but I remember this one scene in the Hound of the Baskervilles. Dr. Mortimer says, "Holmes, they were the footprints of a gigantic hound." I got goosebumps. My hair on my arms stood up and everything. And I was hooked and I read voraciously. And I was loving all of that. I loved solving the puzzles or trying to solve the puzzles. And I recognized, wait a minute, this is great fun to read, but it's also serious literature.
You have 30 seconds now to finish the task. This is the end of task one. Go on to task two. You have 1 minute to read the task.
One of the most fascinating aspects of the 2017 American documentary Becoming Bond is how a summer job led to George Lazenby landing the role of James Bond. In the early 1950s, Lazenby, an Australian teenager, got a job as a used car salesman. Lazenby would go on to become a model and eventually play James Bond in 1969's On Her Majesty's Secret Service. As Becoming Bond shows, the self-confidence Lazenby learned while selling cars was one of the crucial qualities that allowed him to land the role. This is a great example of the benefits a simple summer job can bring. However, what once was an important milestone is now becoming rare. Financial news service Bloomberg recently reported that in July of 2016, 43% of 16 to 19-year-olds were either working or looking for a job. That's 10% lower than in July 2006, and the number is expected to go below 27% in 2024. Bloomberg also cites a study claiming that teenagers' increased emphasis on education is eating away at the teenage summer job. Yet teens who avoid work to study are, ironically, missing the kind of life experience that will make them successful. When I was growing up, if you didn't have a summer job, you didn't have any money. Period. My father was a generous man, but when I'd excitedly tell him that, say, my favorite band was coming to town, the response was always the same. That sounds great. You've got extra money for the entertainment, right? Otherwise, you'll need to find somewhere to work for some extra hours. However, it was also about more than just earning money. A summer job taught me how to interact with many different kinds of people, acquiring social skills that would benefit me throughout life. When I was 15, I worked in a local grocery store, and every day I had to deal with hundreds of customers. Some of them could be difficult, but calmly explaining the store's policy to them taught me about patience and pride in doing a job correctly and responsibly. As well, there were people I met on the job who affected my life choices in ways that never would have happened had I not worked in the summers. When I was a bag boy, the men from the barbershop next door used to stop by the store to talk about sports and life. And it was the local TV sportscaster who stopped by for dinner supplies and gave me advice about getting into journalism. The summer job was part of an entire social and economic ecosystem that helped prepare me for adult life. No matter what summer jobs you had in life, theater usher, bag boy, or painter, you have received an invaluable experience. Well, even James Bond used to work as a used car salesman once.
You have 45 seconds to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
One of the most fascinating aspects of the 2017 American documentary Becoming Bond is how a summer job led to George Lazenby landing the role of James Bond. In the early 1950s, Lazenby, an Australian teenager, got a job as a used car salesman. Lazenby would go on to become a model and eventually play James Bond in 1969's On Her Majesty's Secret Service. As Becoming Bond shows, the self-confidence Lazenby learned while selling cars was one of the crucial qualities that allowed him to land the role. This is a great example of the benefits a simple summer job can bring. However, what once was an important milestone is now becoming rare. Financial news service Bloomberg recently reported that in July of 2016, 43% of 16 to 19-year-olds were either working or looking for a job. That's 10% lower than in July 2006, and the number is expected to go below 27% in 2024. Bloomberg also cites a study claiming that teenagers' increased emphasis on education is eating away at the teenage summer job. Yet teens who avoid work to study are, ironically, missing the kind of life experience that will make them successful. When I was growing up, if you didn't have a summer job, you didn't have any money. Period. My father was a generous man, but when I'd excitedly tell him that, say, my favourite band was coming to town, the response was always the same. That sounds great. You've got extra money for the entertainment, right? Otherwise, you'll need to find somewhere to work for some extra hours. However, it was also about more than just earning money. A summer job taught me how to interact with many different kinds of people, acquiring social skills that would benefit me throughout life. When I was 15, I worked in a local grocery store, and every day I had to deal with hundreds of customers. Some of them could be difficult, but calmly explaining the store's policy to them taught me about patience and pride in doing a job correctly and responsibly. As well, there were people I met on the job who affected my life choices in ways that never would have happened had I not worked in the summers. When I was a bag boy, the men from the barbershop next door used to stop by the store to talk about sports and life. And it was the local TV sportscaster who stopped by for dinner supplies and gave me advice about getting into journalism. The summer job was part of an entire social and economic ecosystem that helped prepare me for adult life. No matter what summer jobs you had in life, theatre usher, bag boy, or painter, You have received an invaluable experience. Well, even James Bond used to work as a used car salesman once.
You have 30 seconds now to finish the task. This is the end of task 2. Go on to task 3. You have 1 minute to read the task.
In January 2017, it was Donald Trump's first press conference as president-elect when the term fake news broke out of media discussion and into the mainstream. So what can we do? So, Julie, I want to start with you.
So I think the number one thing our listeners can do is on social media not to share information unless they are sure it's real news. And particularly in crisis situations.
So what about you, Ross?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, for me, the best thing that anyone can do is just call fake news out when they see it. So if you see somebody on your Facebook sharing something that is clearly fake news and they don't know that it's fake news, correct them. Let them know. Comment, leave a factual link that kind of goes to Snopes, and provide them with information from a quality source. I think that when we call people out for sharing fake news, that allows us to ensure that the goal of fake news, which is to have negative and kind of skewed perceptions imposed on people, we have an ability to kind of curb that.
You know, we should all be reporters ourselves. I think one thing that, you know, previous generations have relied on reporters and journalists to be the ones that dig in and look at the details and make sure that what they're reporting is fully factual. But now with the age of social media, you know, anyone can share any sort of news. So I think we all at a grassroots level have to put our reporter hats on once in a while and think like a reporter and ask a lot of questions, especially if something seems off and doesn't seem right. I've been victim of that where I see, you know, a headline and it's like, oh my God, that's hilarious, or that seems awesome, or that's, you know, a point in my argument that I've been trying to make or something like that. And then I'll hit retweet or something like that. But often what I've been doing lately is trying to be a little bit more accountable to what I'm sharing on my network to make sure that I'm not propagating fake news, and is by just clicking on the link and reading through it.
I think it's just so easy these days to kind of see a headline that kind of resonates with somebody based off of even their own biases. And if something confirms your biases, of course, you're more likely to kind of share it because it's showing you that you were right all along and that idea that you had is correct. So people are more likely to share that content. But I think what we need to do is also recognize that when you click on that link, you get to see the source. You get to see what that URL is. And over time, you get more familiar with knowing, okay, if something's on CNN, if something's on CBC, if something's on one of these credible sources, you have a better chance of knowing, okay, this is legit content. There's a lot of stats that get thrown around these days that kind of come from nowhere. I know there's a stat that says that people are able to kind of connect with images 70 times faster than they can connect with a written word. I've tried to track down the source for this stat, and if any of the listeners know where it is, please let me know. But there is literally nothing but a circle of people sourcing each other without actually getting back to like an actual journal or a study that actually kind of highlighted it. So it's important to always look for who it was that originally kind of came up with a conclusion or came up with a stat.
You have 45 seconds to check your work. Then you will hear the text a second time.
In January 2017, it was Donald Trump's first press conference as president-elect when the term fake news broke out of media discussion and into the mainstream. So what can we do? So, Julie, I want to start with you.
So I think the number one thing our listeners can do is on social media not to share information unless they are sure it's real news. And particularly in crisis situations.
So what about you, Ross?
Yeah, I think at the end of the day, for me, the best thing that anyone can do is just call fake news out when they see it. So if you see somebody on your Facebook sharing something that is clearly fake news and they don't know that it's fake news, correct them. Let them know. Comment, leave a factual link that kind of goes to Snopes, and provide them with information from a quality source. I think that when we call people out for sharing fake news, that allows us to ensure that the goal of fake news, which is to have negative and kind of skewed perceptions imposed on people, we have an ability to kind of curb that.
You know, we should all be reporters ourselves. I think one thing that, you know, previous generations have relied on reporters and journalists to be the ones that dig in and look at the details and make sure that what they're reporting is fully factual. But now with the age of social media, you know, anyone can share any sort of news. So I think we all at a grassroots level have to put our reporter hats on once in a while and think like a reporter and ask a lot of questions, especially if something seems off and doesn't seem right. I've been victim of that where I see, you know, a headline and it's like, oh my God, that's hilarious, or that seems awesome, or that's, you know, a point or a point in my argument that I've been trying to make or something like that. And then I'll hit retweet or something like that. But often what I've been doing lately is trying to be a little bit more accountable to what I'm sharing on my network to make sure that I'm not propagating fake news, and is by just clicking on the link and reading through it.
I think it's just so easy these days to kind of see a headline that kind of resonates with somebody based off of even their own biases. And if something confirms your biases, of course, you're more likely to kind of share it because it's showing you that you were right all along and that idea that you had is correct. So people are more likely to share that content. But I think what we need to do is also recognize that when you click on that link, you get to see the source. You get to see what that URL is. And over time, you get more familiar with knowing, okay, if something's on CNN, if something's on CBC, if something's on one of these credible sources, you have a better chance of knowing, okay, this is legit content. There's a lot of stats that get thrown around these days that kind of come from nowhere. I know there's a stat that says that people are able to kind of connect with images 70 times faster than they can connect with a written word. I've tried to track down the source for this stat, and if any of the listeners know where it is, please let me know. But there is literally nothing but a circle of people sourcing each other without actually getting back to like an actual journal or a study that actually kind of highlighted it. So it's important to always look for who it was that originally kind of came up with a conclusion or came up with a stat.
You have 45 seconds now to finish the task. This is the end of task 3 and the whole listening test.